Welcome to the Thinking Practitioner Podcast,
a podcast where we dig into the fascinating issues, conditions, and quandaries in the massage and manual therapy world today.
I'm Whitney Lowe.
And I'm Till Luca.
Welcome to the Thinking Practitioner.
The Thinking Practitioner Podcast is supported by ABMP, Associated Massage and Bodywork Professionals. ABMP membership gives professional practitioners like you a package, including individual liability insurance, free continuing education, and quick reference apps, online scheduling and payments with PocketSuite, and much more.
And ABMP's CE courses, podcast, and Massage and Bodywork magazine always feature expert voices and new perspectives in the profession, including Till and myself. And Thinking Practitioner listeners can save on joining ABMP at abmp.com/thinking. Welcome again to the Thinking Practitioner Podcast, and we are absolutely delighted to have Greg Lehman here with us today. So, Greg, thank you for joining the Thinking Practitioner with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
For those who don't know you, Greg is incredibly well-versed across a diverse group of fields. You are, if I understand correctly, a physiotherapist, chiropractor, and biomechanist, and all-around research authority on all kinds of stuff, manual therapy. So is that kind of the in a nutshell there?
Well, I mean, I'm not a chiropractor anymore. I let my license go. I don't know if you need your license to call yourself a chiropractor.
Yeah.
And then my I like research, but I don't conduct a lot of research anymore. I just read it. But I did do my master's a long time ago in manual therapy and exercise biomechanics. I only have 25 publications or something like that. So like real researchers, they'll have 200, amazing. I'm a dabbler.
I think there's a lot to be said, however, about your incredible ability to read voraciously on this research and sort of distill a lot of the key points out there for all of us who are focusing on practitioner stuff. So anyway, we certainly do appreciate your work in those areas.
Yeah, I'd be more of a knowledge translator. That would be the better term because I have a pretty diverse background.
Yeah,
and
I was going to say your ability to cite the sources and the variables involved and the sample size for an unbelievable variety of things means I'll never get in an argument with you that relies on citations. That's for sure. I'll go in there.
Yeah, that's my Rain Man skill.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Greg, you've got a new podcast out called Movement Optimism, which I love, by the way. And I wanted to hear a little bit more about that concept of movement optimism. So tell us about that. What is movement optimism? And how does that kind of color your approach to working with people?
So if you think back to a lot of manual therapy or chiro, physio, and massage, a lot of it's predicated on finding faults in people. Mm-hmm. It's you find something that's wrong and then we think we got to go fix it. And that's just not in those fields. I just had a patient who saw their sports medicine doctor, and their sports medicine doctor was just trying to look for all of these things that were, I wouldn't even call them problematic, but they viewed as problematic and being that's why you have pain because this thing over here, this muscle is tight or this isn't firing or you had a previous injury here. You know, it was really a pessimistic view of the body. Viewing the body.
Well, of course.
Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
We don't do that in massage, bodywork, and manual therapy. In fact, I'm right with you. We do that. We do that a lot. So I'm glad you hear you talking.
No, that's everything. And so the impetus was I still like the treatments that everyone's doing. I like the treatments that philosophy inspired. I just thought it needed a reframing and a reconciling. Mm-hmm. And that's the takeoff of movement optimism. It's often what we're doing is we aren't fixing things with people, but we're doing something else to build them up, to help them tolerate these things that may or may not even be problematic, but it's really about building healthy people and, to be more mechanical, healthy systems or healthy ecosystems.
I'm curious about that, the whole concept. I mean, I love the idea, and I see a lot of practitioners moving in the direction of trying to reframe how they think about things to do that more positively. My curiosity is how do you address that from the patient or client's perspective, because they often come in and want to know, like, what's wrong with me? And they kind of want that answer too. So how do you do that from, or how do you address that from their perspective?
Yeah, so, I mean, it depends on your style, but I like simple things. I like to say, like, pain is a result of, like, when all the stressors in your life and your characteristics, who you are as a person, like, once they're greater than what you can handle, you know? So I use the cup analogy for pain, which is like all the stressors and who you are is in your cup. You might have too much too soon, past history of trauma, you know, depression, anxiety, tendinopathy, whatever wear and tear, whatever people are calling it, you know, that's in your cup. And then you have pain when your cup overflows. So I try to give like a pretty holistic explanation for why things hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And then the idea of patient-centered care is we can say, well, what would you like to work on? Like these are the options to help you here, right? There's no one thing that probably needs to be done. There's a lot of things that can help you out. So that's how it's explained to the person. And sometimes it's super simple. They just come in, they tear a muscle. We're like, oh, we're going to build up that muscle. It'll be fine. It'll heal around it. Or, you know, my back hurts because I was gardening all weekend. You don't need to go into childhood trauma or something like that, or their anxiety and depression. You're like, oh, this makes sense. You just did too much too soon for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Except it. Let's calm it down.
You were the first person I saw using that bucket or a cup model, do you call it, where there's multiple factors that can go into something like a pain experience. And it was compelling. And it's been something that I've used since then to help understand how there's many things that go into what we experience as pain or stress. And that the upside of that is many things we can do or many places to start with it as well.
Yeah, that's the optimism of that model, because the biopsychosocial can be not only daunting for therapists because you feel like you have to fix everything, but it can be daunting for people in pain because they're like, oh my God, look at all these things that mess me up. And the better way to view it is like, look at all these things that we could work on, and we don't have to work on everything, right?
Yeah.
You can be anxious and depressed, and you can have a labral tear and joint degeneration, and you can be thriving and living well and be either not just, you can be out of pain, or you can have some pain, but you're not suffering and you're living well. So there's options here.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I wanted to ask, I was curious, I mean, you've been so well known for this wonderful course that you put together years back, Reconciling Biomechanics with Pain Science. And I know it has been available as an in-person course for many years and now also online on your website. I'm curious to know what kinds of things might have changed in your thinking around treating people with pain over the course of the time that's been out. Like,
I always try to change it because I feel like I should. There's pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And then I go back and I look at my old lectures, and I actually have to be cautious in not changing it. That, like, if the course doesn't get into the details, it focuses on fundamentals. And I think once you find good fundamentals, then you run with them. So it's been 10 years, and I honestly, I don't know. I wouldn't really change too much of the fundamentals. If anything, I'm like more open for other avenues of care to achieve those fundamentals.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas maybe in the past I was more, you got to do this, like the things that I liked. And now I'm like, I think there's a lot of ways that we can achieve these fundamentals. So I don't think the fundamentals go out of style.
Yeah. Yeah. Certainly, you know, another thing I was curious about, your background in understanding biomechanics at such a high level and, you know, understanding the rehab processes from your clinical work. I've listened to a number of things that you've said on other podcasts and other places too, and I'm curious to hear about this. This is one of the things that I see a lot in our profession, in our field, that I'm constantly scratching my head about, is this whole issue about faulty firing patterns in muscles. And I'm wondering, like, what's your take on this? Is this something that we could really evaluate with, you know, any kind of credibility, and how much does it matter?
So you certainly can't at a clinical level. It would take EMG to do that. And then even if you have EMG, it takes like, this would be timing, when muscles turn on and when they turn off, and the balance there. we're talking milliseconds here. Like, so this all would have started, you know, the transverse abdominis crease and multifidus, and there'd be delays in firing with people with pain, or it also started with the VMO. People would say the VMO is not firing. And again, it was always firing. It was just delayed 60 milliseconds. And these things don't really matter. And so even the people who started that research are now saying, don't worry about these things. These are epiphenomenon. They're red herring. They're probably a consequence of pain, or they're a consequence of whatever it was that caused the pain. They cause these things as well. But these things aren't the things that need to change to get out of pain. Right, that they're side effects of whatever's causing the pain, and we confuse them. It's like your house is burning down, and I guarantee your fence will be hot. You wouldn't go and cool down your fence with water, thinking that will help the house from burning down. Mm-hmm. That's how you want to view these things, mm-hmm. right? So it's like they might be associated with pain, but they're not really an issue, and they shouldn't like guide your treatment. And so the VMO is the best example. The originators of that, Dr. Cowan and Dr. Crossley, Kate Crossley, they were doing that research 30 years ago. Now
would be vastus medialis involvement and knee pain. Yep.
Yeah, it's just a theory like that if the muscle was inhibited and firing late, it would lead to like a tracking problem in the kneecap. And that's something that you needed to fix. And now they just say, hey, just load it, mm-hmm. you know, like yeah. load that knee up. It's allowed to hurt a little bit. Find the goal task that they want to do. Calm it down, build it back up, mm-hmm. get them doing the things that they love again, address negative beliefs about their knee. And there you go. It can take time, but they'll recover. So they'll even do that.
Yeah. I think you've given me the answer to what I'm about to ask, but let's see. Another one of those areas that gets tossed around a lot is the idea of alignment, especially in my background as a role for a structural integration practitioner, where alignment was, or in many cases still is, the goal in and of itself. And if it's not in alignment, that's thought to be faulty itself. How would you address that? Or let's take it one step further. How would you address a client who comes in who wants to be better aligned or has been told that they're hurting because they're out of alignment?
Yeah. So first thing, you don't want to ask them more questions about what they think, what they think about that alignment, why they think it needs to change, like really understand. And then I'm not saying I'm confrontational, but I often ask, like, can I tell you something that's probably a little bit different than what you've said before, or what you've been told before? And I would say a lot of the thing, like what I'll say is, a lot of the interventions that you might have tried before in the past to change this alignment, they can absolutely help your pain, but your alignment doesn't have to change. You know, like, so someone with scoliosis or a leg length inequality, scoliosis doesn't have to change for you to have less pain. So a lot of the exercise programming or the soft tissue work that people do, trying to change alignment can totally help with pain and function. But when you measure alignment in the long term, nothing changes, and that's okay. So it's sort of like, what if we could get you more comfortable and pain-free in the alignment that you have right now? And I would say sometimes chasing this alignment change is just so frustrating, and it's the wrong thing to chase, and it just makes it harder and harder to recover. So would you be open to that? That's how I'll talk to people with that. And then, of course, sometimes you could change alignment. It'd be like, if you just want someone to have more back flexibility and arch more backwards, sure, then we could work on that as well.
Mm-hmm. So except what you just described was a movement change, not a position change.
Yeah, that's the thing. So you'd have to like go in and say, well, what do you mean by alignment? And they might say, when I do the snatch exercise, or with me, when I do back handsprings, I want to have a greater mobility there. I'm like, oh, we can totally work on that. That's reasonable. And they say, if I want to sit up straight more, I'd be like, well, just sit up straight. There's nothing special to
right,
that.
Right.
Yeah. I ask, why do you want to sit up straighter? Oh, nice. I thought I had to for my back. I'm like, no, it's great. You don't have to if you don't want to.
Well, I mean, again, it's at some point we take the pathway that leads to the table if we're doing manual therapy. But in the conversation, there might also be questions like, what gets in your way? What makes it hard to sit up straight? what happens in those moments when you don't sit up straight? What are your options there?
Yeah.
So there could be lots of inquiry into that.
Yeah, always digging deeper, trying to understand. But and I'll tell everyone, like, there's no doubt I've had patients that are really caught up in thinking that they need to change their alignment and their posture. And I might not be the right person for them. We're all, and I've had those talks, and I apologize. I say, if you can totally see someone else, I'll be here in the future and we can have these talks. So I am gentle with it. So you could potentially lose a client, you know, with this. They might not be ready for it. That's okay.
Would you also say there is a time at which you would possibly maybe just say, like, well, I'm going to zip my lips because this person has a model about what they think is happening, and maybe that's not what's really happening, but it's working for them and they're making headway there?
Oh, absolutely. So yeah. Like, if they're so that they might have a negative belief about the body that isn't unhelpful. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. You got to make that call. So I've had patients that think like their IT band is riddled with scar tissue and stuck to their leg all the way down, and they foam roll it every day. And I don't agree with that, but I don't talk about that because the rehab program that we've come up with together, they're happy with, and they're doing all the other things to help them out, and they're succeeding. So that's not a belief that's worth fighting over, because it's nothing. It's just something else. Who cares? People have different takes on things. And if it's not a barrier to recovery, then don't get into the fight.
Right.
We don't need to argue about narrative.
No.
Just do the work. Yeah. That's right. Okay, here's one that came in to my office in the last couple of months. I worked with two very experienced dancers. Both were over 60, professional dancers, really body people in many ways. Both had SI joint pain, and both happened to say, oh, my SI hurts because it's hypermobile, and there's a lot of things I shouldn't do because, in fact, we're going to do some work. She said, oh, don't work with my SI joint because if it gets more mobile, it's going to hurt.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So what would you say at that point?
So this is where I'd say, you know, where did you hear that? I'd want to know more on their take on that. And then I'd direct, and I apologize. And I'd say, like, I'm sorry. This might be different what you've been told. And sometimes it's frustrating when you have people giving you different information. But here's like my biomechanical take on that, which is like, there's a few
things. Tell us, yeah, briefly, because you and I have spoken about it in the past, but tell us what's your biomechanic thing.
We want the SI joint to move a little bit. It doesn't move a lot. It only moves a couple degrees. It slides a little bit. Even if it's moving a lot, it doesn't mean it's unstable. It just means it's moving. It's a joint that's inherently stable that doesn't take a lot to keep it stable. I mean, if you were in a car accident and there's a fracture, maybe it's unstable, but in general, it's probably not unstable. However, it's super sensitive. It's loaded with nerves back there, and there's only two of them, and it's the connection between your lower body and your upper body, and it takes a lot of stress, and you probably do a lot of activities that stress it a lot, so it's not weird for it to be sensitive. So it's sensitive, it's safe, it's sore, and it's stable, and that would be the idea there. And then I would say, so like a lot of our manual therapy here, what might surprise you as well is it can help with the sensitivity and the pain, but manual therapy, stretching, all these things, this will really surprise you, doesn't make you less stable. We're not able to, this is where you can get into the weeds of like research. Those type of interventions don't decrease our stiffness and don't decrease our stability. Even stretching, where people think it decreases stability of connective tissue, it doesn't. Right. The only thing that decreases stability or stiffness in a joint is going to space, like immobilizing something, and injuries, like actually damaging tissue. So manual therapy is a desensitizer. It can make you feel less stiff. In the short term, you can be less stiff. But in the long term, you are not less stiff. You can just feel better. That's the great thing about it. So there's lots in there. And I'd be like, I'm sorry, that's a lot. Yeah. What do you think about that? Or I'll often just reference someone else and say, go read this. Tell me what you think about it. I can still help you. Like, there's another way that we can think about this.
Yeah, that's great. No, that's great. I started down the other road you described, inquiring about it. And I got to the point where this might be a narrative I don't need to try to challenge today.
Yeah.
These women were very sure about their bodies, and who was I to argue with their experience? So let's do something else and see how it goes.
So what it wouldn't surprise me, I guess, maybe is, I'm just guessing here, is maybe they had some work done before and it really flared them up.
Yes.
And then they just attributed it to instability.
That was the explanation.
Yeah. So I'm cool. Oh, we can avoid that in the future if we want to go after that, because we might be able to, you know, let's take some time. Yeah. So you got to develop that relationship.
I think for it too, what I see, you know, perceptually a lot in our field of, you know, I'm a massage therapist, and so I'll speak from that perspective, is that there is a sense too that people come in with having been told all kinds of different things from lots of different practitioners. And there may be a little bit of an attitude on the part of both the massage therapist practitioner as well as the client. Well, like, I'm just a massage therapist, so how should I question what somebody else has told me who might have more letters after their name? You know, that's got to mean more. It's got to be more accurate.
We all have that. I get that with surgeons and doctors. And then, again, I acknowledge that it can be frustrating because there's people telling different things. And often what I'll do is I'll just refer them to read something else. Like say we're trying to encourage someone to be active and they're worried about having knee OA. I'd be like, go read this article by Dr. Howard Lux. He's an orthopedic surgeon. You know, I almost like I have like a reference list of like other people with lots of letters to say the same thing that I want to say.
Yeah.
Or I like to say there's a grain of truth in what they said, but it's just not everything.
You know,
so are there other things that we can work on here?
Right.
That would be the idea. So you don't have to have those debates. I used to work in clinics that had like 38 doctors. They all be told, you know, you have knee pain because you have knee OA, and then you're doomed. And I'll be like, it's a part of the puzzle.
Osteoarthritis.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, osteoarthritis. It's part of the puzzle, but it's not everything. So let's work on other things.
Yeah. So I know you've been a strong critic of the kinesiopathological model in the past, and also said there are times where it may seem to work. That model might work with some people. I was curious if you can kind of explain a little bit about what you see that model to be, and when does it kind of work and when does it not work?
Yeah. So if you look at the kinesiopath model, it essentially is deviations from a neutral posture where you go far outside of the neutral zone will either create current pain or in the future will lead to some sort of joint degeneration, and you'll have pain in the future. It's sort of saying like there's an optimal way for the body to move, and if you don't move this way, you're more likely to have pain. So knee valgus, the knee caving in, spine flexion. And then, so where I think there's utility and why that model is helpful is, one, someone comes in and their knee hurts or their hip hurts with the valgus movement pattern, and then the therapist says, okay, don't do that. And they just teach them different ways to move that have less pain. And I'm like, great, that will help sometimes. So it wasn't that valgus was faulty and was, you know, leading to long-term damage in the knee. It was just sensitive, and they just taught them other ways to move. It's like anytime you're sitting, like I keep moving around when I sit because something is sore. It doesn't mean my sitting posture was faulty. It was just sore in that position, and then I moved to another one. Like, I'm just as sore if I sit up straight as I am when I slouch.
Right.
Neither of them are faulty.
Yeah.
The other way is when you look, say, like someone like Dr. Shirley Sarman or Linda Van Dillen, Dr. Van Dillen, who does the research with her, is they give you these exercise programs that are designed to change movement patterns and help people, like, to change these patterns to get out of these faulty movement patterns.
Yeah.
And when you look at the exercise program, it's just really comprehensive. And so I would say that exercise program is working not because you changed movement patterns, but because exercise and moving again and loading up the body is just inherently good. That's why it's helpful. It has nothing to do with changing muscle timing or changing how you move.
Yeah.
So like it's really easy to confuse causation, like, oh, this person got better when I did this intervention. Like, say I'm a chiropractor and I crack a neck, therefore their joint was out of place before.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no, that's I'm guessing on the mechanism, and that's what people unfortunately do. And then they double down on their theories.
And create a whole modality empire around it too.
Totally.
That's right.
Totally.
Yeah. So one other thing I want to ask again along sort of the biomechanics route here, lots of people in our fields of massage and manual therapy bow at the altar of the psoas as the root of all problems in the body, you know. I'm curious to hear from like a kind of, at least from the biomechanical point of view, how crucial do you think that is in the realm of a lot of back pain, core function, stability, all those other things where it gets tagged as being responsible for?
Oh, I don't think so at all. I think it's, this is actually, I did some research on this many years ago. I think that all goes back to Vladimir Yanda's hypothesis of the lower cross syndrome, mm-hmm. which essentially is you have a tight hip flexor or psoas, and then therefore you have a weak glute and you have a tight erector spinae and weak abs, and that will cause anterior pelvic tilt. And if you have anterior pelvic tilt, that'll put more stress on the facets in the spine or something like that. That's really the theory. And then when you like, so that's the hypothesis that having more anterior pelvic tilt will cause more pain, cause more stress. And then you have to go back from there and you like look at all the hypothesis and like, so what if you have more stress back there? It's not really a lot of stress. And you rarely maintain that position. As soon as you're walking and bending your hip flexors and moving your back, it'll change the stress. And otherwise, stress is a good thing. It's what catalyzes adaptation. It's not inherently bad. And then when you go even deeper, you're like, well, why does sitting even make your hip flexors like more stiff or decrease their mobility? And maybe not, that's all over the place. And then you have to say, well, can you even decrease the stiffness of your hip flexors? And this will surprise some people, but you can in the short term, like 30 minutes, but in the long term, when we stretch or do manual therapy, it actually doesn't change the stiffness of a muscle. And the stiffness is what would pull a joint into a different position. And so stretching the hip flexors or mobility work or manual therapy might give you more mobility, but it's not going to change the stiffness. So it probably wouldn't even change anterior pelvic tilt. And that'd be like the work of Joan Scannell. I think there's a guy named Stephen Priest who works on this, but he still thinks anterior pelvic tilt is important. But you probably can't even change it because you can't really decrease the stiffness of a muscle at its resting length. So it has all of these, like, you just got to dig deeper. Like, okay, if it's this, then this, then this, what are all the hypotheses? And then you want to go and check all the theories behind it, and you won't see it as being supported. However, I say all that, and then hip flexor work, strength training the glutes, working the glutes, doing manual therapy around that will help people. It's just has nothing to do because you changed the stiffness of the psoas.
Yeah.
That's it.
Oh, well, you're talking about stiffness in the low back makes me think of Stuart McGill,
right,
who has been on the show twice now. And then we had Lorimer Mosley a week or two ago. And afterwards, a listener wrote in and says, listen, I want to hear the two of them talking to each other. And so, so I want to ask you, for our listeners, how would they be seen as representing different points of view? And how do you think that conversation would go?
So, well, here, let me go back a step. I mentioned Joan Scannell's research paper.
Yeah.
McGill was her PhD supervisor.
Okay.
Right?
So that's the lineage, yeah.
So it's his work that has shown that you can't change lumbar posture despite doing all the work to stiffen something up and loosen something up. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a blog that's like 10 years old on that, and then all those things. So, back to what you said, how would they? So one, I guarantee that debate will never happen.
in our imagination, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, McGill's retired, but I never really heard him. I knew him when he was a lot younger, and I was 22. That's when I worked with him, and I'm a great fan. I'm like forever indebted to him. We do disagree on lots of stuff, and I hope that can be done respectfully. The debate would be difficult because I'm concerned that they might talk around each other.
Well,
I don't think Mosley would maybe address the biomechanics and the relevance of tissue to injury. And I'm afraid that maybe McGill would like minimize the role of the neuroscience when it comes to pain. So they would that's what I think would happen. I think a debate is the wrong way to do it. I believe in like a dialectic, which is they both should say, like, don't start from ignorance, but say, how can we get closer to the truth? And I just worry that people being very different like that just might talk around each other. That's it. Mostly would give some explanation for pain that could be totally valid. McGill might give an explanation for pain that's more tissue-based, which in some people absolutely is totally valid, right? Okay. So it's like, and they would just still double down on that, and we wouldn't, I don't know. I don't know if that makes sense. I don't think we get farther ahead. You have to have some humility here, and they're both so successful. Not humility, but I don't know, like openness to the other side, and I don't know if anything would come of that debate.
Well, whether through their own efforts or not, they've come to be somewhat of a figurehead for different points of view, each of them. And so to juxtapose them like that is in some ways juxtaposing the different paradigms. And you're saying there may not be, in spite of the name of your course, Reconciling Biomechanics and Pain Science, there may be a ways that at least the personalities involved aren't the people to be talking about this.
Yeah. So McGill is kind of famous for treating powerlifters or something. I don't know how Mosley would treat a powerlifter who wanted to lift heavy loads again. But that at the same time, I don't know how McGill would treat someone with complex regional pain syndrome, mm-hmm. right? Or phantom limb pain. Like they're almost seeing, yeah, they're both involved with people with pain, but are they really seeing the same people? I think a better debate would maybe be like Peter O'Sullivan and McGill or something like that. Right?
Yeah, both working with different
populations. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
That's right. No, I'm just thinking there was one with Diane Lee, and I have to go look that up, go find that. There was a really rich conversation between her
Anthony Lowe?
Maybe it was Peter O'Sullivan, but I have to go back and talk about that.
So in one of your other recent blog posts, you were talking about cognitive functional therapy. I was curious about that. If you can expound on that a little bit, what that is and how might that play into a lot of the things that we're doing with people?
Yeah, so that's Peter O'Sullivan's group. Mm-hmm. To me, it's one manifestation of the biopsychosocial model, which means that pain is an interplay between the tissue damage, nociception, that's sort of like the irritation signal from the tissue, and how our beliefs, stress, emotions, anxiety interact with that tissue sensitivity, right? And so treatment should be looking at beliefs and cognitions as well as function and biomechanics. Mm-hmm. But Pete would be like very much into the camp of mine, and he's changed through the years, which is like the spine is incredibly robust and adaptable. You're allowed to slouch, you can bend, you can lift a number of different ways. If it hurts, maybe we teach you another way to lift. You know, so it's actually how I practice. So sometimes I'll admit I do like bias. Like I'll say, this research paper is great because it's my bias. So I understand that's not the best way to evaluate something. I am critical of them, though. I'm critical of everything. But they are like my favorite research group, where they really go out of their way they have a theory and then they go and try and test it with RCTs.
Yeah, it's great. You know, this is a great, I'm enjoying the conversation because the chance to empty out my pockets of the little ideas that, what would Greg say about this? Because your thinking was influential for me when I went and did your course, whatever it was, 8-10 years ago. And it's been ruminating quite a bit. So here's one, just this nitty gritty one. What are your views on flat feet and when do they matter?
I mean, they're great for walking on water. That's about it. I actually, so there's the thing, like when you look at the research there, I work with a lot of runners. It's probably my area of expertise. I don't care. I mean, if they have, maybe if they're older and they have like ankle shin pain, I'm a bit worried about a tibialis posterior dysfunction where it's actually like torn. Like, so if it's dysfunctional flat feet, but if someone was just born with flat feet, I would allow them to join the military or it'd be fine. I don't see the research link. So that would be the classic KPM, is that a flat foot is a risk for injury, and in general, it's I don't see the literature saying it is.
The kinesiopathological model says that flat feet are a problem. You're saying the research doesn't bear that out.
I would, yeah. I mean, like, yeah, they'll measure that with a navicular drop test, how the right. that bone in the foot moves. It doesn't seem to tell you who is more likely to get injured. That being said, if you have flat feet and there's a large navicular drop and the inside of your foot hurts when you run or walk, it's totally reasonable to, like, try an orthotic, or tape the foot, or do foot strengthening exercises. You know, that can be helpful for people as well. But I would also do the same thing for people who didn't have flat feet.
Thank you.
Yeah. One of the other things I wanted to kind of hear from you, probably one of your sayings that's gotten the most attention over many years is this idea or thing that you said of calm shit down and build shit back up. And I have thought that so incredibly encapsulates what we all really should be doing. So I'd like to know, like, where did that come from, and what does that kind of like essentially mean to you for those who might not have heard that before?
So it's me, like, it's hard to be a clinician because you can always feel like someone else knows more and someone has all the answers. You know, and so I really like to simplify things and find common threads. And I'm like, why do we have so many people who are disagreeing? And I know that they're all disagreeing, but they would all be able to help the same person. And I was like, so what the hell is going on there? And so that was like, this is it. This is what they're all doing. They calm shit down in some way, meaning like they decrease the sensitivity of the system, manual therapy, acupuncture, like validating the person, you know, tape, or thought, whatever it happens to be, doing a little bit of less, change a little bit less, changing how people move. And then you don't just leave it there. Then it's like, okay, how do we build you back up to do the things that you love again? Which again, so many different ways to do that. Load management, exercise prescription, you know, coaching someone, being there for them and with their setbacks, right? And then I'm like, boom, there. That's how we can all get along.
Yeah. And I wanted to note, too, just for those people who don't know, I've just been astounded by your gracious generosity over the years in sharing information. And for those people that don't know, you've got a fantastic ebook on your site called Recovery Strategies. Can you talk a little bit more about what's in there and who's that really aimed at?
So I love it. I like, there's so much stuff that comes out that you have to buy. There's stuff rewritten all the time. And I was looking at that the other day because I had to, like, someone wanted me to sort of teach it. I was like, should I update this and change it? And I would change maybe 4% of it. Like, again, it's the fundamentals. It's a book that tells people, explains a little bit about pain. It has simple messages. It doesn't go into the hardcore neuroscience, which people don't need to go into. You can read the whole book. It's only 71 pages. You can read the whole book and it can be helpful. Or if you're a clinician and like a massage therapist, there's a section where you can just, it's all set up as infographics, so you can just print out one page and give it to someone, right? Yeah. So that would be one thing about pain. Here, read this about pain. It's like you have this amazing ability to adapt if we get the dose right. Or pain is influenced by lots of things in your life, or you're safe but sore. Whatever the key message that you want someone to understand.
Yeah.
So I'm proud of that book, and it's open access. I don't want people to feel like you don't even have to sign up with your email anymore. It's just a PDF. It's translated. I had so many wonderful people. I said, anyone who wants to translate this, you can translate it. So I think it might be in, I don't know, 7 or 10 languages. And that's all free on the website.
Yeah, it's great.
I wish people would do more of that.
We'll link to that in the show notes. And then you're also just kudos on your podcast. Just started listening to that the other day. And it was great to hear you getting going with your wish list of guests there.
Yeah.
And I especially liked it that you said, hey, you know, I'm going to keep it to under half an hour.
That was, I haven't done that yet, but it's a little dry.
I haven't done that either.
It's aspirational.
I saw that. So I was like, how do you have a conversation with Greg in under half an hour?
You should see, I just shut my mouth. You wouldn't even recognize me. My wife doesn't know who I am.
We'll put a link to that as well. But I was intrigued by one of your blog posts recently where you said that the need to stay updated on research is probably oversold.
Oh, yeah.
So can you tell us a bit more about that?
It is. I think once you get your,
I'd like to know too. Did you get hammered for that?
No, I actually got more support for that. Again, like I feel there's this push in our professions to make people feel like they don't know enough, mm-hmm. and it really bothers me. And I'm like, if you've done your work at the start, you have your fundamentals, and then the fundamentals really aren't changing. Every time I read the state of the art review, I'm like, it's not state of the art, and it'll just be the fundamentals rehash, like too much too soon. We've all known this for sport injuries or any injury, but then now people will call it the acute to chronic workload ratio, and I have all these papers on it. I got to read all these papers, and they don't say anything more than just don't do too much too soon. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, fuck, we knew that 30 years ago, or like all these things. I swear newer research is just undoing our love affair with older research that we never should have listened to in the first place. So people are like, oh, you got to read the new research on the spine where all these different things, exercises can help with low back pain. You don't have to do multifidus training. And I'm like, well, we shouldn't have been adopting the multifidus training without reservations 25 years ago. So that new research is only new and helpful because you were wrong for adopting the old research too quickly. Mm-hmm. So if we didn't have that old research, we would have been fine.
Yeah.
And you're essentially fighting the patho academic model that says we don't know enough.
Right. Yeah.
That I feel horrible for academics. I think I even had an apology in there. They have this pressure to produce, you know, and they have this pressure to write a discussion that says this is why it's relevant, and they should just be writing, we have no idea if this is going to be relevant.
Yeah.
We'll put it out there. Maybe you can use it. Maybe it'll make sense 20 years from now because someone else built on it.
Yeah. I think this was something that you said to me when I was in your class a number of years ago. If it wasn't attributed to you, then correct me on it. But you had said something like, you know how a lot of the biomechanics research out there gets done. It's like, you go into the lab and you look around and you see like, well, what do we have equipment that we can measure? And so then that's what the paper or the study gets done on.
It. I mean, it's a little offensive, but mm-hmm. certainly with my master's, I was like, I have to do something. And so I just took something that someone else did for another part of the body and I applied it here. Mm-hmm. Or you're like, oh, I want to study low back pain. So you're going to do sort of something that your supervisor did. And that's actually useful in some way because you're building a body of knowledge in that area. But like, usually we just do that where we do like a cross-sectional study. How are people different with low back pain? And they'll find some variable. There's like 100 variables where when you have low back pain, you're different than someone who doesn't have low back pain. But then no one is able to go on and do the next step, which is like, well, why do we even care about these things? Mm-hmm. That's my jadedness.
Yeah. And there is inherently a catch-22 in this. And I think this was, in your discussion with Ebony Rio on your podcast recently, noting that if you're going to do good quality research, you have to isolate a variable and say, we've excluded everything else except this one thing that we're studying and going to measure it. But in reality, that's not how a treatment actually works. Many times in the clinic, because a lot of times it works because of all these things that you do together and mix them all in there.
So it depends on your research design and what you're trying to prove or the question you have. You can do pragmatic trials. So I just had Neil Mai on the podcast, and he's the kettlebell physio. He did a pragmatic trial that just looked at training older adults with kettlebells. And the program was almost different. It wasn't a recipe program. It was different for everyone just to see how they would all see. I'll change. So it was like he's almost testing. This is how people do it in the wild. It doesn't let him answer a research question like this is superior to this, or why did this research, why is it helpful? Like, why is this intervention helpful? Mm-hmm. So you can do pragmatic stuff, which is fine. But it's tough with Ebony's is a good example of that. She did like isometric training, neuroplastic training, where it's paced to a metronome, right? And then she did it isometric, which is not moving, and then isotonic and paced to a metronome. And then both groups got better. So you can't say much. You could say you got those two interventions that you can do, but we have no idea why.
Yeah. Well, Greg, that's probably a good place for us to kind of wrap up here today. But I want to thank you so much for your spending some time with us here today and in our earbuds. And for those of our listeners, where can people find out more about you, what you're doing, where you're teaching, what kinds of things you're up to?
So I'm all over the world with teaching. The next few months, it's like I'm in Miami, Florida. That's cool. I've never been there before. In April. And then in March, I'm in Ottawa and Gilbert, Arizona. And I'm in the UK, if anyone's in the UK, sometime in the next few months. And then greglehman.ca is just my website. That has everything there. And that's Instagram and Twitter as well. And then That's where the workbook is. The free workbook's there. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, if you work with people with knee osteoarthritis, I do have a free webpage that I think is excellent too, compared to the stuff you can buy, which is called OA Optimism. It's just like 5 to 7 minute educational videos, and education is a hallmark of good treatment, and basic exercise stuff, because we overcomplicate exercise and you don't need to.
Yeah. Well, wonderful. It certainly has given us a great deal of food for thought here, and also a seed for, hopefully we can have you come back again and talk to us about some more stuff some other time. This has been extremely rich and extremely valuable here.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So Books of Discovery has been a part of the massage therapy and bodywork world for over 25 years, and nearly 3,000 schools around the globe teach with their textbooks, e-textbooks, and digital resources. Books of Discovery likes to say learning adventures start here, and they find that same spirit here on the Thinking Practitioner podcast and are proud to support our work, knowing we share the mission to bring the massage and bodywork community thought-provoking and enlivening content that advances our profession.
Instructors of manual therapy education programs can request complimentary copies of Books of Discovery's textbooks to review for use in their programs. Please reach out at booksofdiscovery.com. Listeners like you can explore their collection of learning resources for anatomy, pathology, kinesiology, physiology, ethics, and business mastery at booksofdiscovery.com, where Thinking Practitioner listeners save 15% by entering Thinking at checkout.
So again, thanks to all of our listeners and to our sponsors here. You can stop by our sites for our videos, show notes, transcripts, and any extras. You can find that over on my site at academyofclinicalmassage.com. And Till, where can they find that with you?
advanced-trainings.com. If you have comments, questions, or things you'd like to hear us talk about, guests you'd like us to invite, just record a short voice memo on your phone and email it to us at info@thethinkingpractitioner.com. Maybe we'll play it on the air. You can also just write us a regular email. Or you can look for us on social media. I am at Till Luca, my name. Whitney, where can people find you?
Also under my name, Whitney Lowe, on social media. You can, if you will, rate us on Apple Podcasts. It does help other people find the show, and you can hear us on Spotify, Stitcher, Podbean, or wherever else you happen to listen. So please do share the word, tell a friend, and thanks again very much for listening. And Greg, thanks again so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Greg.